The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And on this Eurovision night, what's another year? Do we need more time for the National Maternity Hospital decision? Making your mind up, Geoffrey Donaldson co-ops his Lagan Valley seat. Hold me now, EU vows to protect Ireland's place in the single market. And that's rich, inflation and rents hit new highs. We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio tonight, a little later than usual, to discuss all kinds of everything. OK, I'm going to stop that now. We have Green Party Senator Roisin Garvey, Sinn Féin Senator Len Boylan and Labour Senator Marie Sherlock. And joining us down the line is Gráinne Ní Fhéidh, Dublin reporter with the Press Association. We want to hear from you as well, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551. Email us on latedebate@rte.ie or you can tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Now, there was more debate on the National Maternity Hospital in the Dáil this afternoon, and then we had day two of the Oireachtas Health Committee sessions on this issue this evening, and more discussion in both forums on that contentious phrase knitted into the deal, which would allow for all clinically appropriate procedures to be carried out in the new hospital. The Master of Holistry, Shane Higgins, said this was future proofing so that the hospital would remain a maternity hospital. But Solicitor Simon McGarr said the phrase would be open to interpretation and it could be removed, as it was the state that asked for this language to be included in the first place.
It is extremely ambiguous and it allows a doctor to take away autonomy and decision making from a woman, and it allows an interpretation of the law, if you like, in a particular circumstance. Now, the most egregious example of that was pre-repeal with Miss P, the well-known case of the woman who was brain dead, and the doctors interpreted that it was clinically inappropriate to turn off to allow her effectively to complete her death because she happened to be pregnant. So that is a sort of situation. Now, a woman could turn up, say, present herself for a termination at less than 12 weeks, which she's perfectly entitled to make a decision about herself. And the doctor might say, well, look, I actually don't think this is clinically appropriate.
OK, and from a legal perspective, Mr. McGarr, would you see there's a level of ambiguity?
I'm afraid that because clinically appropriate is placed so highly in the hierarchy of permitted uses, in the hierarchy of the principal object of the company, it's the fulcrum upon which the entire set of agreements rests. And depending on its interpretation, these agreements could proceed exactly as the state parties have described their intention to be, or they could proceed in a very different way.
And that was actually, of course, the former master of the National Maternity Hospital, Peter Boylan, that you heard first there, giving the committee examples of how the term clinically appropriate could be interpreted in certain circumstances. And then finally, in response to Sinn Féin's David Cullinan, that was Solicitor Simon McGarr, again, giving his view on that contentious phrase. Gráinne Ní Fhéidh, Stephen Donnelly was asked about that phrase today, about that term, clinically appropriate.
Yeah, and, you know, there's been a lot of time spent on this week in general between the Health Committee, time in the Dáil today, back at the Health Committee today. And a lot of the questioning does come back to that phrase, clinically appropriate. The Minister and the Government, in fairness to them, seem to have answered a lot of the other qualms, but this is the sticking point. And basically, because it's a condition for the use of the hospital, you know, that this is a hospital for maternity care, for procedures that are clinically appropriate. On one hand, the government is saying we mean maternity care, anything that is maternal when we say clinically appropriate, that's why it's in there. On the other hand, opposition TDs and others have voiced concerns that that could be used to say, well, it's taking, if a woman is opting in for something for like an abortion or even a tubal ligation, that a doctor could argue, well, that's not clinically appropriate because you don't need those services. And that's where the concern lies. Now, obviously, the government would say, and they have been saying that time and time again, there are phrases in the Constitution that say anything that is legally permissible in the state at that time can take place, and also that there will be no religious influence. And I think the minister said it's mentioned 6 times in the Constitution that there will be no religious influence. But it's the ambiguity that is the issue. No one is arguing that doctors will definitely prevent women from being able to opt into these services, but it's the ambiguity where something could happen that isn't ideal. And when we're setting up a maternity hospital, it's meant to be state of the art, and there's ambiguity around what a woman can opt in for. It's, and obviously there's the specter of religious influence, but that's not really the crux of the issue. The crux of the issue is that if this isn't done right, we're going to be looking at similar issues that we spent a lot of the past couple of years promising and debating how they can never happen again.
But there was a sense today that this could be our way out of this, really. Wasn't there that we could get this
phrase
language
corrected.
Changed?
And
it turns out actually it wasn't I think it had been assumed by many all along that this was put in by the St. Vincent's Hospital Group side of the negotiation, but it appears this was a HSE inclusion.
And the government said that no, what they were worried about was that a couple of years down the line that the state might say, well, we're actually going to use that hospital for other things other than maternity care. And the HSE themselves insisted on putting clinically appropriate in there to mean maternity care. If that's the point of that phrase, I don't think it does that job very well, because there are more clear ways to say this hospital is explicitly for maternity care. But yeah, you're right. There was mention that, you know, I think it was Roisin Shorthall that said, can you change that phrase? Because that would alleviate a lot of the concerns that we have as, you know, pushing against this deal, this co-location plan as it exists now. Can you change that phrase to clarify it? Because if it's the government that put it in the first place, or the HSE that suggested putting it in, then it can be changed without disrupting the plan.
Yeah, and the ministers, sorry to cut across, I'm just watching the time because we came to the programme so late. I want to try and get through our agenda here, Gwanya. But he said, he kind of indicated that he would look at it, right?
He didn't say he wouldn't look at it, but yeah, he said he didn't commit to anything in the Dáil, just as he didn't commit to changing anything in the committee either. But that in itself is progress, I suppose. Now the Taoiseach and Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, have said that they don't expect any massive changes to the proposals going to cabinet, but
there is room for manoeuvre. Let's see what Roisin Garvey, what's your understanding of where this stands tonight? Because I know that the current master of the National Maternity Hospital, Shane Higgins, he said he has no issue with the removal or inserting some definition of this phrase. And, you know, clearly this has become such a bugbear in the discussions around this.
It's funny because the issues seem to be moving now. We seem to be definitely stuck on this one final thing. And I know the term was included at the request of the HSE, not St. Vincent's themselves, which is reassuring, I suppose. And as you said, it is to ensure that only maternity procedures are carried out in the hospital.
But do you think it should be changed?
I suppose if it helps reassure people, maybe it's something the minister has to look at. I don't know what he's planning on doing. I personally, having listened to Professor Shane Higgins and lots of others in this, and I had a lot of similar qualms as other people, but I personally feel reassured this. And the clinicians themselves
Have you gone on a journey, as the young people say these days? Did you start at the start of this saying, I'm worried about this? And you know,
when you hear it first, you always hear the negative stuff. So it's like, oh my God, church and state and the church are all over this. And then you realise, actually, none of that is actually true. You know,
now, your colleague Nessa Horgan is not still at.
She's not concerned about the church's involvement. She is concerned about this phrase, right, clinically appropriate. And I respect her. I personally feel reassured. She is looking for further reassurances, I believe, from the minister.
She says her position, she'd be very, her position is in doubt, her position in government.
She said it'd be difficult, I think. Yeah, but I mean, we do have, you know, there's always going to be difficulties. I'm not surprised she's saying that. She's looking for further clarity on that phrase, and maybe the minister will be forthcoming with it. I personally
would you be concerned that you may be about to lose a colleague?
I don't think so. I mean, I met NASA this evening and we had a good chat about it, and I think it'll be okay. I think we'll get there in the end. You know, this is healthy debate. It is good that it was delayed, and it is good that it trashed out.
Do you think it should go through on Tuesday?
I would hope that it would. Yeah, I would hope that it would.
Okay. Lynn Boylan.
Well, I suppose the whole point of the delay was to allow people to have access to address their concerns. And if it's going to be just an exercise where people are talking, we're hearing different opinions, I think there's still a lot of ambiguity around that phrase. That's part of it. But also people...
If they just whip that out.
Well, that would be helpful, definitely.
And would that be enough?
I still have an issue with the fact that this was originally supposed to be a gift to the state. And we're in a situation where almost €1 billion of public money is going to be spent on an asset that we don't own. And I mean, the currency had a very interesting article.
No,
we'll
own the assets, we just won't own the land.
They had a very interesting article at the weekend saying it's about the property, stupid, because the companies, they're offshore companies. Their taxes are paid in particular countries for a particular reason, and they will be able to use that asset. There's a reason why...
As in to borrow against it.
Exactly. It's going to be a valuable asset to have on their books. So I still think that we should be putting a very strong case to the Sisters of Charity to go back to what the original arrangement was. This is a public hospital on public land. And I mean, Leo Varadkar said it in 2019, Eamon Ryan in 2017, Micheál Martin in 2021.
But sorry, just to clarify, the hospital building will be owned by the state. It won't be an asset. You know what I mean? It'll be an asset, a state asset.
But it's the uses of that building will be able to be used to effectively leverage finance.
Okay, and just a couple of messages, because we're getting a big reaction to this, and we've spent many nights on it in the studio now, and a lot of them from this side of it saying here in the new maternity hospital debacle, remember the old saying, decide in haste, repent at leisure. And another listener says, I'm probably as right wing as there is on social issues, but I cannot understand why the state can't be outright owners of this hospital. Scrap this lease lark, they say. Marie.
Yeah, Katie, look, even if there is a change between now and Tuesday, and I don't believe there will, you know, it'll be cosmetic in nature.
If they took that phrase out of it, surely that would be a significant change.
The reason we're having this debate, right, is because this is a new hospital that the state is putting, as Lynn said, almost €1 billion into it, and it's not a fully public hospital. It's a public-private hospital. We have two owners of the hospital, the St. Vincent's Hospital Group and the state. Three private directors, the private company able to appoint a chair once every 6 years. So the reality is there's a private influence on this new hospital. And it's a lousy deal. Like the reality is this has been a government failure to stand up to the St. Vincent's Hospital Group. It's been, you know, there's been a failure to go out and CPO it. And, you know, 2017, Leo Varadkar said then that it would take too long to CPO the grounds. Like there's been a moving of the goalposts at every juncture here. And we wouldn't have any of this debate if there was a confidence in knowing that everybody on that board was appointed by the Minister for Health, and that the land on which the hospital exists is fully publicly owned. And unless we resolve,
but you see, I could imagine now if I was coming at it from Roisin's perspective or from the government perspective in relation to this, they'd say, well, the opposition to this are moving the goalposts as well, because one day it's about, oh, we can't have the nuns having control over our healthcare. Then the next day, well, the nuns are gone. Okay, well, it's a poor deal for the state anyway. And then, you know, there has been a shifting of the sands around
strongly
the debate
disagree.
On this.
And you know, to be frank, like, there's a lot of talk about the nuns and religious. Any private involvement, right? Mm-hmm. Any private involvement, no matter what colour, shade or perspective of the person, you know, should not be involved in what is a new hospital.
And do you accept at all what has been said and was said on the record of the last number of days again, that the legal advice is that a CPO might not necessarily succeed because this particular lease that has been offered would be seen as... Yeah, because the bar is so high, you have to have like no other alternative except a CPO. And there is this, what would be seen as a viable alternative.
Well, let's set out a few facts now with regards to CPO, because again, it's thrown out that it'll take a long time or whatever. So a CPO is, when it takes place, there's possession of the property first, and then the arbitration then takes place, right? The second thing is we have CPOs happening up and down this country with regards to roads and greenways
and
schools.
What happens then if the CPO fails? So we take possession,
which is highly
likely. Start building. Like, would you actually start building in circumstances where the ownership issue is still not?
I think you would. Like, I think the thing is we haven't seen the legal advice, and the government are hiding behind the legal advice, as often happened. But the reality is that the state
could take
position. You
don't accept that legal advice is as we've been told?
No, I don't. And I think we would need to see it to be able to properly interrogate it. But certainly I've heard plenty of others talking about, and indeed, you know, my colleague Brendan Howland would say that, like, is in a CPO process that happens up and down this country every single day. You take possession of the site first and the arbitration happens afterwards. And if it were to fail, right, and it's highly unlikely, because at the end of the day, the site, it, like, is not that there's a, you know, so many sites across Dublin that this hospital could go. There's very few sites. But then you're into a whole new process. But the reality is we need a new hospital, a new maternity hospital in Dublin. We need to get it started ASAP, but we cannot afford, like, for, you know, what we're doing now, right, is we're casting a cloud over this hospital for many years to come. And while it might be fine over the next 5 or 10 years, a decision that may come forward in 20 or 30 years time, and because of the way the constitution is set up, could have all sorts of implications for the running of the hospital. And that's what we're trying to prevent here.
I agree. There is a certain rhetoric that is casting a cloud over the hospital. But a CPO would likely only succeed if the courts believe the state had no other option for establishing a successful maternity hospital. Given that there is an alternative, accepting St Vincent's offer of a 10-year lease, the courts would unlikely approve of a CPO. And that's just a fact. So, you know, we have to bear that in mind. And I think the bottom line is...
Well, that's a legal opinion.
It is legal opinion. Yeah. I mean, do we trust any legal opinion on anything anymore?
No, but I mean, it's an opinion, as in we don't know how the courts would respond to this.
I also trust all the clinicians who think that they will be able to carry out all their duties that they're carrying out right now in the hospital.
Can I just put you in, though, Roisin? Because, yeah. I mean, well, obviously, we've had this back and forth now for the last 10 days of this of this round of it. It's been going on for years. Do you get a sense, though, that you've brought the people with you, or the people who are pushing for this deal to go through have actually brought, because there's going to be a protest, we understand, this weekend. We'll see, you know, how many people turn out for that. But do you get a sense from the people who are contacting you that people's minds have been changed in relation to this in the last number of days? Because we know that the opinion polls have shown a big majority who are not comfortable with this deal.
And there's a growing anger.
I think what's really important is that if you listen to the people who are probably most important to you, who are the people who will be working in the hospital, and if they firmly believed...
Sorry, surely the people who are going to be the clients of the hospital are the most important.
And many clients were on to me saying they wanted built because of the inability of Holles Street to cope. Like, we do need a maternity hospital, and everybody agrees on that.
That's not my question. My question do you have any sense that the tide is turning in terms of public opinion?
I think it's very hard to get the real facts out there when there is a populist opinion that's spun as well. So it is very difficult. But I think the proof will be in the pudding.
I think people will see when the hospital is built, they will see that there will be better service for women of Ireland, which is what we need. People like Simon McGarr, who are giving up their time free and are offering to meet with political parties and to brief them.
You know, Professor Shane Higgins.
Dr. Boylan. Yeah, but you're saying that the people who are opposed to this particular deal are populist and it's rhetoric.
No, not all of them. Some people are, definitely. It's
really, really insulting, because at the time of the mother and baby homes, when they were going to seal the files, we were told this is misinformation. And one senator went in and accused that it was a politically orchestrated campaign. And then when Stephen Donnelly came out, when they paused the decision, came out and said there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I think that's deeply insulting to people who have genuine concerns and want to have those concerns aired and want to know that the government are receptive to listening to those concerns
and not just saying
we're going to have a 2-week pause, hopefully the dust is going to settle on this and then we'll just proceed anyway. And that's I think is actually feeding a lot of anger among people going why bother pausing it if you're just going to railroad it through anyway not listen.
But the truth will prevail, I think, which is important. And I think if we can get a hospital built that will do everything we needed to do.
Are you going to do that in the teeth of the kind of opposition and feeling that appears to be out there?
Well, I mean, people have stopped giving out about the nuns being involved, and that was the main problem in the beginning. Now that seems to be has been completely dropped.
I don't know if that has been completely dropped.
But the rhetoric was out there that the nuns would be involved. We have proved now that that's not true, so they've stopped raising that, and now they're stuck on the words of this thing, these two words, clinical. What are the two words everybody's talking about?
Clinically appropriate.
But I just think that, you know, it is interesting that in the beginning, people's main concern seemed to be that the church would be involved. And that was the huge issue, which I can see why that would be a huge issue. Now, those concerns have been alleviated, and that's a very positive thing.
Are your concerns alleviated?
No,
on that
they're
front?
Not. And I think it does a real disservice.
You think the church are going to be involved?
No,
with this?
I, Roisin, you heard me say very clearly a few minutes ago that, like as in any private involvement in this hospital, should not be facilitated or allowed. And I think there's an important distinction here because, you know, if I were a clinician in Holles Street, I'd probably be saying, get a new hospital built as soon as possible. And I totally see where they're coming from. But as legislators, as those of us who have to, you know, look to the longer term, right, then there is an onus and a responsibility as and all the correspondence we've got into our offices, and I've got a lot, and I'm sure Lynn and Roisin have got it as well. People are really
angry because they
see this as kowtowing to a private interest, and we're not clear as to down the road what influence that private interest is going to have. And I've heard the minister talk about his golden share, but anybody who has sat around a board of directors, no, it's not about votes, it's about influence, right? How somebody exerts an influence, and there'll be three directors, and they're not just looking after the plot of land upon which the hospital is built, right? Like there's three of them there, and they will get to be, one of them will get to be the chair in a period of time. So I think there are very serious questions here, and Lynn raised it earlier about how the fine, you know, like as in by having the church on the balance sheet of the wider St. Vincent's group, what implications will that have for the private hospital and indeed for the public hospital? So I think all these questions remain unanswered, and that is why
but
people are so
unhappy. I just think it's really disingenuous because the Religious Sisters of Charity will have no rights or influence over the appointment of directors. And
you're
that's
the only
fact.
Person talking
that's,
about the religious
that's
here.
That's a completely different point to the one Marie was making there.
But I don't know what your fear is based on. Like, are you afraid that things will change? You know, what's your genuine
I think
fear?
One of the main fears that people have is that clinically appropriate.
Yes, that
it
phrase
creates enough legal ambiguity that we can do better on. And it's a very clear thing that can be changed to neaten things up and to solidify kind of what exactly would happen at the hospital. And I think part of the reason why there's such strength of feeling on this from people who are opposed or have concerns about it is because of what's happened in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that.
That is no small thing in this debate.
Like,
and it's,
for somebody who was a single mother, I went through public healthcare and maternity services, and like we in Ennis, we had our last mother and baby home closed in 1995. 4 years later, I was a single mother. So, you know, I also have huge concerns. But in this instance, I don't. I'm just being honest about it. And I didn't go in naive, but I trust people like Professor Shane Higgins. I trust the people who say they're working, they're happy with what they'll be able to do as doctors and nurses and consultants. I think.
Okay. And do you doubt Professor Madden, who is Professor of Medical Law and Ethics?
Yeah, he's a different
opinion. You doubt
he's
Professor
a different
Madden.
Opinion, yeah.
Deirdre Madden.
I trust Professor Shane Higgins because he's master of the hospital. And I do.
But not the person with the legal expertise and the expertise in medical ethics.
But there has been legal expertise got on this. I mean, if we thought that we couldn't be able to do this, we wouldn't do it. I mean, I genuinely think this is what we have to do now.
But we're referring to a member of the board, Roisin,
like,
there.
The government doesn't want anything year threatening that will happen either. You know what I mean?
Okay. No, but sorry, Grian, I'm going to leave it there because I'm looking at the time. We'll take our first break, and we will be back talking about cost of living and inflation after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the annual rate of inflation rose to 7% in April. That's according to figures published by the Central Statistics Office, the highest inflation rate in 22 years. And that comes with the latest report from DAF.ie showing that listed rents rose at an annual rate of just over 10% in the last 3 months of last year. Grainne, you might just dig into some of those price rises outlined by the CSO today. Some of them very, very hefty.
Yeah, and you know, it's a bit like the rents story. We're kind of used to seeing figures representing kind of how bad inflation has gotten, but these are quite striking. You know, one of the two kind of areas that have been hit the hardest are transport and energy categories. But even when you dig into the nitty gritty of those two things, you know, airfares are up by 93% since last April. Diesel prices are up 24%, petrol and diesel prices are up 24% and 40% respectively. And then you have the electricity prices up 28%, gas prices up 50%, home heating oil has soared to over 90 8% in just 12 months. It is really eye-watering stuff, and that all trickles down into how you produce, particularly with energy, how you produce various goods. So even, you know, a loaf of bread, I think, has gone up by an 800 gram slice pan has gone up by 13 cent in 12 months. So that is just a flavour of kind of how striking it is for people. And, you know, it's not we're not even at the upper end of how serious it is. And I think the 7% inflation rate overall, it was the last time it was that high was November 2000. But before that, I think it goes, you have to go back to the 40s or something like that to find a rate that high.
It is staggering. And also, like when you mentioned some of the specifics there, stuff like bread, milk, pasta, like the absolute basics that, you know, somebody who is struggling on a low income would be depending on if they were trying to feed a family. It's really grim, Roisin Garvey. Mm. Like what kind of discussions are you having or are being had within the government parties about where we should go with it?
The government is as aware as anybody else of the challenges still facing households. And I think in particular related to energy bills and especially those on lower incomes. I mean, we have seen over 2 billion in supports and targeted measures since the last budget to help families meet these costs. It's obviously not enough and we've got more to do. I hope to see a lot more in the budget in October. Just last week, we brought down the cost of public transport, which will affect 800,000 people. And over
that was a good
300,000 young people will have half price fares. So that, you know,
I think that was
we can't do everything overnight, but I do see a lot.
A genuinely welcomed move. And particularly that age group, as you say, where people are forming habits about how they move around. Lynn.
Yeah, I mean, I think the transport was great for where there is public transport. It's a really welcome measure. The problem is there's lots of people in rural Ireland who don't have public transport.
And yeah, I'm one of them, but we can't do everything overnight.
They're the ones who are facing those really extreme rises in fuel costs and putting pressure on them. But the rent is particularly one that I think there is a lot more that could be done because the cost of your accommodation is one of the biggest bills for a lot of households, particularly those who are in the private rental sector. And those figures today, you know, coinciding with the fact that there's so few properties as well, it means that landlords are holding all the cards when it comes to even what they're charging in rent because you literally don't have anywhere else to go.
But on the opposite side of that, we're hearing is that one of the problems is the reason there is less than 1,000 properties available for rent on DAF today is because so many landlords are exiting the industry. So, I mean, the rhetoric around landlords are holding all the cards isn't going to help us in terms of encouraging people to stay in the sector.
And there will be landlords who are leaving, and they're going to leave because there was a lot of those, what you call the accidental landlord, who had a property. It was in negative equity for a long time and property values have recovered. And they're going to leave and they're going to get out now. I mean, and that makes sense for them. They probably never wanted to be a landlord in the first place. Or they've realised that being a landlord is actually a job. Do you know what I mean? And it's not something that you can just, you know, it's not a passive of exercise. But we also need to address the fact that you have people who are genuinely good landlords, small scale, maybe have one or two properties. And when you compare the tax for those type of landlords with the type of tax breaks that the big build to rent, the funds are getting.
I'm just wondering why we don't hear more about that. Tax breaks for the landlords, as you say, not the big corporate fund.
What the government should be doing is going to landlords and saying, if we can get better security of tenure and better, better standards in the accommodation, well, then we can work with you as well and bring about a parity of esteem.
And would the opposition, would you support that in Sinn Féin?
And that's something we have said repeatedly, that it's deeply unfair that you have one tax system for the smaller landlords and then the big corporate landlords are paying literally no tax.
Yeah, because there is a very onerous tax burden on smaller landlords. Marie Sherlock, would you agree?
They pay, obviously, you know, income tax on what they earn. And I suppose, you know, we've been saying for a long time that being a landlord has to be treated like any other business in this country, and with that then all the various expenses.
But doesn't have to when we are in the bind we are in, with such an issue with supply of rental properties. should there be better breaks for landlords
I think in the first instance needs to be treated like, you know, a business as opposed to some sort of midway between, you know, the mom and pop operation and what proper businesses are. But I think the reality is that, like, is in, you know, we need to look at how landlords are taxed. We also need to look at the decisions that those who own second or third homes, what they're doing with regards to choosing to put houses on Airbnb versus private rental. And, you know, an analysis that my colleague, Senator Rebecca Moynihan, undertook showed that, you know, so many counties across this country, I think with the exception of Dublin, there are more houses on Airbnb than there are on daft.ie. And that tells a story in itself. Mm-hmm. The local authorities are failing to clamp down on short-term rentals.
I was going to say, to Airbnb. All of those short-term rentals legally registered?
No.
Surely not.
They're not registered.
No, and the way around that is that the platform that advertises them gets the fine, and that's the way you clamp down it. So a penalty kicks in if the likes of the Airbnb is advertising these properties, they don't have planning permission for their use, then they should be fined, and that fine should be exponential, and you'll very quickly clamp down on it. This idea that the local authorities are trying to, because I mean the local authorities should be doing better, but equally
they probably have enough to be doing.
These
to
are
be
really
fair.
Big corporations yeah. that are hosting platforms,
and I think the important thing is when we talk about housing as well, you know, like as in we're always talking about more money going into housing, but we have to look at what the state is currently spending in housing, and it's choosing to spend almost 250 million on the Help to Buy scheme. We have this Croí Cónaithe scheme, which, you know, frankly, you know, is a case of giving money to developers because, like,
they've unused the planning permission.
And really, we have to look at how are we using that housing budget. Like, you know,
there's families
across Dublin. Like, I have a family. There's a young woman and her daughter. They're being given €1,900 to spend under Homeless Half in Dublin. They cannot find an apartment to live for love nor money. And so, you know, we're putting money into HAP. We're putting money into, again, like as in, you know, I suppose,
and
not
distorting the market, but because of the actual sheer scale of the amount of subsidies gone into that market.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're perpetuating a reliance on the private sector. And ultimately, unless we change that tide, unless actually the state directly puts money in. And you know, we've seen in terms of, like, is it how far behind the social housing targets are going to be, the cost rental.
Well, no, I'm sure
so much says and whispers about that. Cost rental last year, 65. I mean, we need about 4,000 to just meet demand.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm sure the minister would say that the Croí Cónaithe scheme, which is the scheme we talked about last night, 450 million being put into this scheme to encourage building in parts where there's a viability gap in terms of how much it costs to build in these places.
Yeah, I think there is a huge, there is a housing crisis, without a doubt. I what I do see the government doing is some useful things. Of course, the most effective way to assist renters in the medium to long term is to increase supply and accelerate delivery. And we are spending 4 billion a year in housing. You know, that it's not as if we're not doing anything.
Can we look at that scheme we talked about last night, the 450 million for the Croí Cónaithe scheme? Like, the arrangements there just seem to be extraordinary, that builders, developers can access a funding of up to 140,000 euro per apartment unit without any commitment that of how much profit can be taken on that, of what affordability levels that those apartments are going to be sold at, that those apartments can be sold at a market rate which will be apparently put out there. At the time those apartments are sold, and the people who buy those apartments can't move them on for 10 years because their developer got a subsidy that they had no part of.
And would it not help increase supply though, if we, because I mean builders are struggling to cover the cost of buildings, because we all know the cost of building has gone up,
but at a market rate in these places is like 600,000 per apartment. What good is that going to be for people? I mean, how many people are going to have the kind of salaries that could get a mortgage to buy those apartments?
I do know that we have brought in something that has never been brought in before, and the Green Party were the ones that pushed it, and it's the cost rental model, which we see work very well in other countries. And I do think that we're planning to build 2,000 homes a year, just cost rental. And cost rental is a very, we have some already in place this year, but of course we didn't get much built this year because we had COVID. But I mean, there are high targets, and we are hoping everybody wants to improve housing, and we are spending money on it. And I do see a wide range of things. I think the 2% rent pressure zone cap is useful. All new tenancies created on or after 11th of June will become tenancies of unlimited duration, which I think is really important, because I think
the pressure zone cap. But when you look at where rents have gone in the last couple of years, well, when you know we've had pressures on caps, you know, for a long time in place now. And then for a big period of this time, there was actually a cap on rent increases of any kind.
Yeah.
But look where we are.
Yeah, I think there is an issue with also enforcement as well, because we have lots of derelict sites that we're not getting, like local authorities are not taking over. I think with the rent pressure zones, we have to look at that, and we have to do it better. And I also think, but we do also need to increase the places that have rent pressure zones. And as Senator Sherlock said, there is a huge issue with Airbnbs, and this is something I've raised numerous times, and colleagues of mine, Steve.
Why isn't anything being done about it?
Yeah, I suppose they are saying now that they're going to look at Airbnbs and restricting it more, because it is ridiculous that you can get Airbnbs. This is an issue ever. We have this issue in North Clare as well. We need to seriously look at Airbnbs and limiting them. And
we've been talking about this, as Senator
Boylan said,
for years now,
themselves.
But the big problem as well is that unless you actually tackle the housing crisis, it's nearly like a vicious circle, because we've seen we're going to be short 50,000 building construction workers. And then there's another article, I think, today in The Independent that was saying the reasons why engineers and builders were leaving. And they were saying because, you can't afford the cost of living in Ireland. And this was before the cost of living crisis. They left Ireland because of the low pay, the poor working conditions, and the fact that it was so expensive to actually have accommodation.
Yeah,
so we're losing
the
workers that we need to keep here because we're not tackling and addressing.
So we're feeding into the problem.
We have to increase our housing. Brings me nicely to
the Labour campaign being launched for a living wage.
Yeah, so look, I suppose, Katie, we've been talking for a while now that obviously, like, inflation is affecting everybody, right? But of course, it's affecting the lowest paid the worst, because they're least capable of being able to cope with any increases in the cost of living. So we need to see, I suppose, increases in pay from employers. And of course, we need to see increases from the state in terms of supports with regards to access and public services, free GP care, in terms of education. But what we have, published this week, or there was a debate in the Dáil on Tuesday, was with regards to our living wage bill, which effectively is to make good a government commitment. So to be fair, there is a government commitment to introduce a living wage, but it's over 5 years. Low paid workers can't wait 5 years. So, you know, we have the minimum wage at 10.50 at the moment in this country. About 130,000 workers are on the minimum wage. About a fifth to a quarter of all workers are classified as low pay. Ireland has got a real low pay issue. There's many workers that are decently paid, but there's a very large share of workers that are low paid, and many of them also happen to be renting. So they're at the very harsh end of those cost of living increases at this point in time.
I think it's
so
good to see the Labour Party backing policies that the Green Party got inserted into the programme for government. The Low Pay Commission submitted its living wage report to the Taoiseach at the end of March.
Wonderful.
And it is being reviewed. So it is wonderful.
But you need action, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's no good.
It is being reviewed.
That is no
good. You can't just
roll
it out overnight, though. Yeah,
no,
the commission has been completed.
Sorry, right?
It's only gone to the Taoiseach since the end of March.
We've known for a long
time. It has been reviewed, and it is planned to publish it along with supporting
the
Labour
government.
I just say that I'm glad both of the parties have come to the living wage, because if we're going to play that game, Sinn Féin has been the party of the living wage for a very long time, and back in 2013.
As have we.
And back in 2013, we submitted amendments when Jed Nash actually was the minister. And he opposed
those amendments. Who set up the living wage, the low pay commission.
To give the low pay commission
We wouldn't have had the increases in the minimum wage unless we had a low pay commission.
But we asked him at that stage to actually include in the schedule of what the low pay commission would be looking at is to look at moving towards the living wage. And at the time, Jed Nash's comments were that the living wage is a concept, and that it's something that society should push for, and that employers should voluntarily opt into.
It's interesting now that Lynn chooses to try and attack attack us here for something back in 2013.
No, no, I'm just
nothing about Fianna Fáil.
I'm feeling we're in the middle of a mutually assured destruction scenario here.
No. The Taoiseach has actually asked the Commission to make recommendations to him on how best Ireland can achieve this commitment, and they have done so, and he just got that at the end of March.
Can I just suggest that, we're all agreed here, the living wage is something to be aspired to and to be campaigned for and to be put into legislation. Yes. We're all on the one page on that. Okay, I'm going to leave that one there. I've just a couple of minutes. I just want to touch on that really important exchanges and phone calls and everything else that's been happening in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol. Grainne, relations between ourselves and the British government, between the British government and the European Commission, are all becoming very, very tense.
Things are fraying at the seams. There was a call, obviously, between Liz Truss and Mara Sefcovic today. And usually after these high-level talks, you get a statement saying there were frank discussions on both sides. That usually means they told each other what they disagreed with each other over. And then you have a kind of a holding statement to say our officials will meet next week and then we'll meet the week after in person or over the phone. But this seemed different. There were reports that, you know, Boris Johnson could give a statement as soon as next Monday about why he was tearing up the protocol and that he would be giving Sefcovic a deadline to do something about it before he announces it. And then what happened after Sefcovic gave an interview to Seán Ó Murray of Euronews and said he was really despondent and quite testy. And then European Minister Thomas Byrne was speaking on Drive Time, who also was bristling at questions about the protocol,
bristling,
which is quite unusual.
But saying, and I'm just going to put this back into the room here. Sorry, Grainne, we've only a minute left. Yeah. But Lynn, Thomas Byrne saying he doesn't believe that Boris Johnson is going to do this, that Liz Truss is going to do this, that this is more sabre rattling.
I think it is more sabre rattling, but it is very dangerous sabre rattling. But I think certainly when you have the America coming out and that ad hoc committee on the Good Friday Agreement saying this is really ill-judged, I don't think they're going to do it. I think maybe Britain feel that if they're just going to wear everybody down to a point of exhaustion that they'll give in. But I really think that at the end of the day, you can't unilaterally walk away from an international agreement. And I think they know that.
But even if they're now saying the legal advice is that...
Even if they're saying that, I mean, you
back to legal advice, Roisin.
Yes, are we going to accept legal advice now? The protocol was designed and agreed by the UK, so it's just, it's very British Empire of them, really, isn't it? You know, the Empire have decided to just change their minds. What's interesting to me is to hear that 63% of people in Northern Ireland think this is a positive thing. The protocol presents Northern Ireland with unique economic opportunities. And I suppose I served on the Oireachtas Committee for the protocol, and we were up in Belfast, and I think the British are just playing silly games.
Okay, I'm going to have to, I'm sorry, I can't let you back in, Marie. We're actually out of time. I'll take that last break.
Email latedebate@rte.ie.